I won't say that all the facts were actually as I had sort of discussed them.
However, know that, right.
Yes. The basis of this talk is really, I think, to give you my impressions, my recollections of the city of Nunawading in particular, maybe some of Blackburn as it was even before I became an employee, an officer of the council. I think I'm going to have trouble with my glasses here. It's all right. It's all right. I'll go over the top. Look, no, I'm all right. That's okay. I won't bother to put them there.
No,
I can see everybody.
We can.
You're
on the air. At least that's got rid of all my nerves anyway. I thought I'd start by just giving you some personal details of my own, and whilst I'm here primarily as a planner, my sort of training was originally as a civil engineer, and one of your guests today, Bill Morgan, and I go back. Actually, it was a nice surprise to see Bill here, because we first met when we were members of the school committee at North Blackburn Primary School. After that we socialised a bit and we played squash together, but we both got a little bit past that, so it's nice to meet. The civil engineering aspect of my training was at what was then called Melbourne Technical College, which afterwards became the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology and now is a university. I worked for about 9 years before coming to the city of Nunawading for the Department of Civil Aviation, which of course was a Commonwealth Government department. And I guess one of my main impressions when I came from there to Nunawading was the more dedicated employee, I guess, being much closer to their constituency than was the case with the Commonwealth Government. But I did enjoy the time I was at the Department of Civil Aviation, and that spanned about 9 years. And before that, I spent a year or so with the State Rivers and Water Supply Commission in what was their soil testing laboratory in East Melbourne. And that was a different type of training again. Actually, in November 59, the city of Nunawading advertised for an engineering assistant. And I had previously made an application when I was living at Thornbury to the city of Preston for an engineering position, or a drafting position, I think it probably was. And I must have always had some sort of a feel for local government, I think, because when I saw this advertisement for the city of Nunawading, I thought, here's an opportunity. The Commonwealth Government at that time, of course, was moving all its public servants to Canberra. And I just established a home in Blackburn, and I really didn't fancy that particularly, but working in Nunawading was a real attraction. So I applied for one of these positions and never heard anything. And it went through Christmas, and sometime, I think, probably in about February of 1960, and this is how things worked in those days, Mr. Black, the city engineer, called at my home one Saturday morning. And he said, are you still interested in this position that you applied for? And I said, oh, yes. So he said, oh, well, we think you'll be successful, so we'd like you to come and join us. So I did, and I started in the engineer's office in 1960 in March. And actually, it's rather interesting that this aerial photograph, which I've borrowed from the city of Whitehorse, which used to hang on one wall of my office when I was at the city of Nunawading, it's actually a 1960 photograph, so it fits in nicely with my coming to work at the city of Nunawading. Actually, I think it's dated February 1960, so I can find a few locations on that which will be of some interest to you. As a Blackburn resident, like most young people in those days, I guess we were all sort of looking for somewhere to set up a home, and we toured, my wife and I, before she was my wife actually, about 2 years, Used to go out at the weekend, look around for a block of land, and finally we came across one up in near Springfield Road. It's actually on here. I think our house is on here. It's about there, if I can point there somewhere. And it was a block of land, and only a block of land, on what was called Gill's Springfield Road Estate. And Gill, of course, was an orchardist, and he apparently decided that probably his rates and taxes were becoming too much, and the best thing for him to do was to subdivide his land. So that was a block of land which we purchased in 1952. We met a salesman on the property one Saturday or Sunday, and we decided, yes, it was what we'd been looking for. It was on the high side of the street, and it sort of it seemed to have everything we thought we wanted in those days. And we paid him £1 deposit, part deposit, on the spot. I think it cost us about £260 altogether. And it's like everybody else, if only we'd had a bit more money, we would have bought four of them. But of course, that was all we could afford. It was, as I say, it was just a block of land. There was no road. Where the road would have been was formed in earth. It had no drains at all. There were no water supply, no electricity, no gas, no sewer, no phone, nothing. Just a block of land. But I think, to me, that was a typified sort of Nunawading and Blackburn, and probably Mitcham and East Burwood, and not Vermont so much, perhaps, because you can see on here, particularly Vermont South, for those who can't see, Vermont South was pretty much still orchards. But I'm going back to 52, 54, and we were then married and set up our home there, and maybe I can digress a little bit more, because I'm sure many others did just exactly what we did. Of course, in the winter time, when you went out in your car, you had to take a shovel in the back, because you'd probably get bogged between your place and the made road. We used to our house was sort of built by us with some assistance of tradesmen, but because of financial constraints and so on, we moved in as soon as we were married, and at that time the plaster wasn't finished, and all the floors weren't down, and so it became a bit of a sort of, I guess, a pioneering spirit that we brought with us to Nunawading. My father, who was a cabinet maker, was making us our bedroom suite, and of course, like all good tradesmen, never got it finished in time, so we had a mattress which we supported on, actually we were going to support it on four 4-gallon drums, only we only had three. So what we did to balance it up was we had an old kitchen chair which I had to cut the legs shorter so that we balanced it, and that was our bed. But they were just sort of things that I'm sure many, many others who came to live out here at that time had to endure. Nunawading at that time, from what I've been able to ascertain, the population of Nunawading in 1951 was about 20,000 people. In 1961, it had already grown to 55,000 people. And I think, again, from recollection, 47, so about 4 years prior to the 20,000 people, there were only about 11. So it was an enormous influx of people to this area. From 61 to 81, a period of 20 years, the population grew from 55,000 to 97,000, which was actually the peak population figure for the city of Nunawading. After 1981, it started to drop away, particularly in the older areas. They were older then. whilst Vermont South was still increasing in population, Blackburn and Mitcham were starting to reduce. So we saw an enormous population influx. Just going back to the form of subdivision that we moved to, I mentioned there was no water or no electricity. We actually had to pay to the Box Hill Electric Supply £30 per pole to have the electricity connected. That was in the form of a loan, so that in fact we got that repaid after I think about 18 months or 2 years after electricity had been extended. We also had to extend a water pipe from Springfield Road. Here's Springfield Road along here and Middleborough Road there. That's the corner of Springfield Road and Beverly Crescent. So we had to bring a water pipe from there down Beverly Crescent and along Kevin Avenue there, which is another thing that we had to do in order to have water available. Now, of course, and largely due to pressure from municipal councils, these days you can't subdivide land, of course, unless you provide everything. You have to have the roads made, the drains are in, the sewers in. All the services have to go with the subdivision, and it's certainly a better way of doing things than it was in those days. The powers of local government came slowly. The roads were the first things that councils were able to require developers to build, and gradually the other services came as well. Velda, I think you better tell me how long I can go, because I'm just as likely to keep going. We had
an hour and a half.
Okay, thanks Ted. We had a traditional structure at the council, of course, where the town clerk was the person in charge, and the city engineer was virtually his equal in terms of authority. The town clerk at Nunawading when I started was Mr. Charlesworth, who was always A. Roy Charlesworth, and his name alone was enough to intimidate people, I think. He had a reputation for being not a tyrant so much as being someone who really liked things run by the rules. He had an assistant there, a chap named Roy McKinnon, who unfortunately I read just a matter of a few months ago passed away, and Roy used to really protect Mr. Charlesworth from those on the staff who really didn't have any business worrying the town clerk or keeping him from his more important duties. The engineer, as I mentioned, was Malcolm Black, and Malcolm was a real gentleman who stayed with the council, I think, until probably the early 70s. The deputies there, I think Mr. Charlesworth had no deputy when I started, but he was in rather poor health. He'd been off at various times, and a chap by the name of John Brown, who was the Shire Secretary before that at the Shire of Corryong, came and took acting duties and ultimately became the town clerk, and John was another very gentlemanly person. The deputy engineer was Bill Sewett, who many would know either personally or have some knowledge of his exploits, probably as a young boy around this area of Mitcham and later as he grew up. And Bill, I guess, was a person that was sort of taken from us a bit earlier than he should have been. He was a really dedicated council officer. Did a lot of things as an engineer in local government, was probably instrumental in getting sewerage as a requirement for subdivision, because in those days we had vast areas of Vermont South and other parts which were subject to subdivision, and that particularly because it drained to the Dandenong Creek where there was no sewer. Bill was concerned and put a lot of effort into trying to make sewerage a requirement that council could put on subdivisions. One other person that I can perhaps just mention, because he was rather easy to identify around the place at that time, and the offices of course is where the Country Roads Board were, and they're moving too, I see again now. The ranger at the time was a chap named Eric Charles, and if anyone remembers seeing Eric, he used to ride a piebald pony around, and he used to tether it at the side door of the council offices when he came in to report, and he was an easily identifiable officer of the council when he used to do his rounds. We had very poor facilities, of course, in those days. We worked in a very cramped office. It was, while I was there, it was extended at the back by the addition of a timber annex, which we moved our engineering drawing office into. We virtually had no vehicles except one comma truck which we used to go out on field duties with. It was commonly called the Whizzer, because that's really what it was like to go in when you had to go out. They used to take you out on field duty and leave you. We couldn't afford the luxury of having a vehicle standing there all day, so they used to take you down to Rooks Road or somewhere and leave you and say, we'll come back and get you after lunch or after noon. And I can remember being in Rooks Road one afternoon and being absolutely convinced I was going to be there all night, because they didn't come to get me until about 4:30. But anyway, the need for facilities was continuing to grow, and we also at one time occupied what was called the Depot House, a house on the north side about where the Civic Centre is now. Was occupied by some of our design staff for a while, because there was nowhere else for them to go. One other officer that I'll mention later was Ron Gray, who you would know as being the person after whom the R.E. Gray Reserve was named. And he was personally to me a very much a person that I looked up to and took a lot of direction from. In those days, and I haven't got on to planning yet, so I'll have to hurry, we had more than 100 miles of private streets to be made. And I know at one time there was a concerted effort made by the council to catch up with this backlog of unmade streets. And you can see them on here, they stand out fairly easily. All these sort of pale lines are all formed roads, unmade. All these up in here, and down in these areas here. The council made an effort at one time, put all its available funding towards the construction, and the target was they would build 30 miles of private streets in 30 months, and that was achieved. So it was a pretty good effort. The issues in then, and this is one of the things that I think highlights my time, the issues in those early days were simple. The issues were, do what has to be done, build the roads and take care of those things, those basic requirements. Now, of course, things are much more complicated. The issues are much more diverse. The requirements of the community are much harder to meet. Perhaps if I do just speak a little bit about Ron Gray. He was a great storyteller, and he always used to come back with stories of people around the community. I can remember going with him early in the piece to the reserve, which was named after him, and he always used to come back with a native orchid that he would have found somewhere there, and he was very keen on those things. But he had other people that you're probably mostly aware of. Nara Road, just up here off Wattle Valley Road, and Nara Road was a piece of land before it was Nara Road, which was owned by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Neave. Mr. Neave and Mr. Gray never used to get on very well, and Mr. Gray used to come back after he'd been out to inspect his proposed subdivision, and he'd say, well, I've had another shouting match with Mr. Neave across the valley. And when he saw Mr. Neave coming, he would go in the other direction and they'd shout at one another across the way. Up near Good Govan's Road, the other side of the railway, there was a lady there, Miss Linda Roberts, who Mr. Gray often used to come back and say, I've seen Miss, she's on her way to the Oaks, she's all dressed up and she looks marvellous. Miss Roberts had some sort of difficulty with some of her neighbours, and she created a piece of land which used to extend from from Heatherdale Road right through to the other end of the school. It was a piece of land about 40 feet wide and the whole length through there, and I think she created it for some purpose which would have annoyed her neighbours in particular about getting access to their property. The other, from Purchase Street it used to go, that's right through from Purchase Street to Heatherdale Road. The other people that Mr. Gray often used to have run-ins were the Wilsons. And if you remember, the Wilsons used to own the property where the Civic Centre is. And Edith and Herbert were the couple. And Edith and Herbert used to be annoyed when Mr. Gray had to go around, and he was the one required to go and talk to them about acquisition of their property. And at one time I remember he came back looking rather pale, and Herbert had actually taken a shot at him with his rifle. So they were great identities too. You used to see them walking back from Mitcham with their little pram, and Herbert had feet, which I'm sure he had about size 16 boots. He was a strange couple. About that time, and actually through Mr. Gray, Mr. Gray was a land surveyor who worked overseas. He was actually working in Malaya for a British company when war broke out, and he was actually interned by the Japanese, and after the war he was released and came back here. And his health suffered a lot because of those days when he was interned, but he had great stories. As I say, I can remember initially going out with Mr. Gray, and he was a proper surveyor, and he used to say, "Now you hold your plan with north pointing up the page, and you face north and you squat down with your plan, and then you can carry on from there." So that was his basic instruction to any of us about carrying out field work. He also used to do the reports to the council, which were required to respond to applications under the planning scheme, or interim development order as it was in those days. And he used to draft the reports that used to go through the engineer to the council, and they were required by the Board of Works, which was the planning authority, and they used to write to the council and say, "We've got this application for something or other up in one of your part of your municipality, and you've got 28 days or whatever the time was to respond to this." So the council used to process these applications in that way. The council in those days made no planning decisions. They responded to applications and used to advise the Board of Works what their views were, whether they had no objection or did object on certain grounds. So Mr. Gray used to do that, but as I mentioned, his health was again poor, and it's amazing how so many of the officers that I went through the council with really, I suppose, grew into positions because their predecessors were either in poor health or for some other reason. And I know Don Wilson, who ultimately became the city engineer and city manager, had no aspirations beyond the job that he did, but because Bill Sewart passed away, Don Wilson became city engineer and then ultimately city manager. So these things happen, and Mr. Gray being ill and me being sort of, I think more because I sat next to him in the office, but anyway, for whatever reason, I was asked to do some of these reports. So I sort of became, without sort of needing to do anything more than just be there, became involved in planning matters. The council, in fact, had its own planning scheme, even in those days, but it only covered a small part of the city. It covered that part of the city from Springvale Road to Springfield Road, up as far as Goodwin Street and back to Whitehorse Road. And it really was drawn up in order to close a lot of narrow streets which were close together. And there were little streets in here that you can still sort of see the remnants of, which that planning scheme was drawn up to in order to formally close those. It was the simplest way of doing it. It never was used for much else, although it's interesting that on that planning scheme there was provision for a shopping centre. It never ever was achieved, but it used to be generally in this area of Tunstall Park, which is just in here behind the school. And I think the as I say, the purpose of the scheme was to close the road. That ultimately was achieved, and the scheme was then abandoned or terminated at the conclusion of those activities. I mentioned the interim development order of the Melbourne Metropolitan Scheme, I think, was drawn up, and Bill Morgan, who was a Board of Works officer, probably knows almost as much about this as I ever did. It was administered by the Board of Works, and it became a planning scheme about, many years, I think probably not much before about 64 or something, it became an approved planning scheme. Under the interim development order, everything was permissible, subject to a permit. Nothing was prohibited. But as the scheme became a formal scheme and was approved, there were certain things, certain uses, certain developments which were prohibited in certain zones. Perhaps if I just go to the map and point out the things that seem to me to be fairly, the most dramatic changes. Whitehorse Road was, except for a little part of Blackburn here, was an undivided road. It had a single bitumen strip up the middle and trees, and it had some service roads, but generally it was like the other roads. Springvale Road was the same. I can remember this part of Springvale Road here was very undulating and narrow and trees growing right to the edge. And wasn't there a furor when the council decided to construct Springvale Road and those trees were under threat? Nowadays, median planting sort of has had an opportunity to regrow. The pipe track's an interesting thing that cuts through here. This is the Mitcham Reservoir, and there's a part of the pipe track here, and I'm not too sure actually where it comes from up here, but it goes right through the municipality, down through there, and right down there. And that, of course, is a main water supply route for Maine, and that's probably more in Bill's area of interest. The creeks, which are pretty obvious, the Mullum, Coonung Creek along there, and some of the others, the Blackburn Lake here, and you can follow the way the watercourses go down through there, and these down here. Cochrane Street, I can remember being impassable when I started. Cochrane Street was a swamp. You couldn't get through there at all. Lake Road we used to call the Red X Trial. We used to have to go down onto Lake Road, and this part of Lake Road around here, again, was, if it hadn't been graded for a while, it was almost impassable, and the whizzer really used to take off down there. The parks are pretty interesting. Some of them, there's Halliday Park, and I think, you can see how they've developed. Walker Park here, Morton Park, some of the newer ones, and I guess in those days, if I can get my bearings, Coonung Reserve wasn't even there. So, as someone mentioned before about Mitcham Tech, and I noticed on here when I was looking at this that, if I can find it, I'll just get my bearings here, up this way further, am I? Here. The Mitcham Tech wasn't even there. That's the Mitcham Tech site. There's Walker Park.
That was an orchard there.
That was an orchard, yes. And you can see the orchards by the little spotty trees all over the place, and mainly down here. Now, there are some features, and some of you are going to have trouble seeing these, but way down on the corner here of Springvale Road and Burwood Highway is the MMBW dumping station, which was there until fairly recently and used by sewage contractors to dump sewage into the board system. The tally-ho boys...
Atlanta put him in the grave over it.
Yeah.
Very young because they acquired that land.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, it was one of those essential things. We didn't get the sewer onto our place probably for about 10 years after we moved there, I think, something like that, about 62. And again, we had to wait for the road a long time as well. Tally-ho Boys Home and Village was transformed, I guess, by Lend-Lease ultimately into, well, part of it anyway, and other parts. In Arla Village, I noticed, was in here, just a collection of a few small buildings compared to what it is now. Channel O wasn't there in those days either. The schools, I've mentioned some of those. The shopping centres, well, that's one of the big planning issues, but Forest Hill Shopping Centre is virtually just under construction then. I can remember when the council was interested in setting up the first library, Malcolm Black asked me to go down, because at that time the Forest Hill Shopping Centre was virtually a ghost set of buildings. I think there was one milk bar that was functioning there in those days, and Malcolm Black had one option that the council was looking at, was to set up the library in one of the buildings down there, which was at that time vacant. The council decided other sort of way to set up its library in the end, but that centre was sort of really just a ghost centre in those days. One of the features of planning in those early days that the regional authority was keen on and developers were keen on was to set up small groups of convenience shops, and you probably all know of neighbourhoods where they are these days, because they were overtaken by drive-in shopping centres. But you'll find in most areas where there are small groups of shops, I can think of one just up here which will be easier to show you, in Diana Drive somewhere, up here, I think just there. They used to set up little groups of about 10 or 12 shops, and they were intended to have your milk bar, your fish and chip shop, your ladies' hairdresser, all those little shops, the butcher, the fruiterer, greengrocer, and a lot of them did. Kerrymuir still functions pretty much for that purpose, but there's not many have survived. Most of them you'll find have got printing works or small factories or warehouses or stores or something in them. As I say, they were really taken over by the drive-in shopping centres. And there's a few of those that are not on this map which exists now. North Blackburn Square, which is on the corner of Williams Road, just there, was Pierce's Orchard in those days. And Ron Pierce used to get very worried about this dam that's here that used to be... It used to pick up all the sullage water from this area up here, and it used to go straight into his dam, and he used to get very annoyed about that because he couldn't water his trees with all this polluted water. But anyway, he did all right. He sold his land for the shopping centre, I guess. The quarries were still around. Somebody mentioned before about brick builders roofing and trading, and they were the ones on the corner of Springvale Road. Here, there. Rooks Road, right on the corner. The builders roofing and trading, I think, was that one.
The Montague Tree there too.
Yeah. Well, I remember that quarry hole quite distinctly as being still there. Hollinson's had a timber yard just next to here, and they used to have a big hole that got full of water that became so stained by the timber that they used to cut, because they used to mill some timber there. Feiglin's timber yard and the hostel is still there. Commonwealth Pottery was up near us, and they used to light up their kilns with coal in their days when we first moved there, and my wife's washing used to suffer terribly from the fallout of that. Gradually they went on to oil, and then they went on to natural gas, and the pollution problem disappeared, so that was good. Like this quarry I always found rather interesting, if I can get my bearings again there, because when it was subdivided, the quarry hole was still left in the middle of Thornton Crescent, and we had a man came along once to us in the planning office and said, I'd like to fill that quarry with car bodies. And we said, oh, you're kidding, aren't you? It was an enormous hole. And he said, no, that's what I want to do. So he used to flatten the car bodies right down flat, squash them and put layers of them into that quarry hole. And eventually he built it right up virtually to the top, and then they just reclaimed it with soil. It's mostly under car park, but there are some buildings fairly close to the edge of that. The Blackburn Quarry, which was, I think, Blackburn Tile Company, which is down here, is still there, down in Alfred Street. They didn't worry about that. They just pushed all the trees and everything, building rubble and everything, into that, and they virtually couldn't ever build on that again. But they built a big warehouse, and they needed a big car park, so that's what happened to that one. Giel's Quarry, in Giel Brothers down in here, which is now Retirement Village, down in here, Springvale Road. That's about all, I think. Daniel Robertson's were still there in those days. poultry farms were an interesting land use in Nunawading, and I always remember this one in Whitehorse Road, which I think was on the here, right, goes right down there, and it had, yeah, the Foot family were the owners, and they had a rather Spanish looking frontage on their arched brickwork and so forth around the front of their poultry farm, so that was rather interesting. The last one I can remember was early one year up in Surrey Road, Blackburn, here somewhere, which I think that was it there in behind there, so, and there was one that I also remember down off Orchard Grove somewhere down there. I don't know that there's too much more. The Civic Centre, of course, was developed on the land where the old council depot used to be. Some of the uses, another name that was mentioned before, Daniel Harvey, still had his business going here in Whitehorse Road, somewhere here. And they were still manufacturing farm equipment and so forth. One that we used to hear from at my place up here was Miller's Drop Forge, which used to be still conducted just here near Moncrief Avenue somewhere. Insel wool was a bit of a source of pollution, and I think largely was one of the reasons why the residents in King and Ceylon Street wanted to get out of there, and that was an issue that was very much topical. King and Ceylon Street are these two streets here. Down this end they used to have the brickworks and some industrial and commercial development, and on the other side they had Insel wool, and they were sort of in a little residential island in there, and the council engaged Loader and Bailey consultants to do some resident surveys there at one time, and it was one of those very difficult community consultation processes where about 45% of the people wanted to get out and about 55% of people wanted to stay there, and gradually as time went by that percentage swung in favour of people moving out and selling and getting some value for their property and having it developed for other than residential purposes, and that's ultimately what happened. A couple of other uses that I can remember are the Blue Moon Fruit Co-op down in Blackburn, and Greenway's Fine Pottery, which was just in here, where near the Blackburn Hotel. The use that sort of came and went in that time, which probably not many people remember now, was the White Horse Hotel. And the White Horse Hotel was on the corner of Moncrief Avenue for a time, and was one of those uses that, you know, didn't last. So not often that hotels disappear for other purposes. One that I can remember down in Burwood Highway was Mitchell's Motor Wreckers, and just along from where the East Burwood Reserve is there. I think if the highway hadn't gone through, it probably would have probably still been there, but it had to be widened and moved back. So that's what happened to Mitchell's motor wrecking yard. The town planning issues that... am I taking too much time? Or no, am I right? the time that I was involved in engineering was up until about 69. The council took delegation from the Board of Works under the planning scheme in 69. I think they were asked to take delegation in 68. The Board of Works decided that local authorities could by that time administer the planning scheme. And the council advertised for an officer to be the town planner, and Kevin Mithen was appointed by the council. Kevin at that time was a qualified planner who had been working with the Town and Country Planning Board. And he came to the council in 69 to be in charge of the planning scheme. And again, because of my previous involvement in planning issues, I was appointed his assistant. So that was in 69. And Kevin left in 79 to go to the city of Doncaster and Templestowe as the planner. And at that time I was appointed statutory planner, so that was about the beginning of 1980, until about 83, when the council did some restructuring, some reorganisation into a corporate organisation, and I was appointed strategic planner, and I was in that position until 89 when I retired. If I could just turn to some comments that I've found. This is a publication from the Town Planning Association, goes back to 1925, and there's some comments in here. This is their annual report of 1925, and it talks about traffic, and I've just highlighted. This is what they had to say about traffic in 1925. We still have the traffic problem with us. We still have it with us. What we said a year ago, and this organisation started. Congestion at Prince's Bridge, because the greater part of the traffic should not be there. Instead of providing bridges and roads for the foreign, in inverted commas, traffic, we occasionally appoint another constable for point duty. That was their way of dealing with traffic problems in those days. Traffic management, of course, is one of the issues. It's been with us for a few years now, and it's one that local government, I know, takes very seriously, and one that Velda has had a lot of involvement with. I'll just skip a couple of these, I think. It talks about reserves and about reserving land for open space. It just says, we have had during the year many attempts of nibbling away our parks. No club is too small and no institution too big to steal the people's parks. Nothing's changed. Zoning was something fairly new in those days, and it just says the most we have succeeded in doing yet in this matter is limiting shop and factory areas. Most of our metropolitan towns and cities now do this. Shops, factories and residences, powerhouses, etc., all have their uses, and all should be provided for suitably. The indiscriminate mixing that we still have in places is objectionable from every point of view. We understand that the Town Planning Commission purposes attacking this problem shortly. May we have the energy to carry out its recommendations. I think that's probably enough of that. I had a couple of other little things I was going to talk about, but I might, I think you might be all getting a bit weary.
Not your dust run, you've got to remember, this is the future too.
All right. Well, I guess during my time at the council, probably the most sustained issue that's sort of carried right through the whole of that time has been flats development. I have a copy of a letter which was sent out to me. Obviously it's still got a little note on it that Bill Sewitt wrote, copy for my information. And it's a copy of a letter from Rupert Hamer, who at that time was the Minister for Local Government. Minister for Local Government. And it's dated the 28th of February 68. It's a letter that was addressed to all municipal clerks. And it talks about the concern that was very much felt at that time about flat development and how it should be controlled. So I guess if I just make a comment here, it talks about how the flat development had become so rife throughout the metropolitan area. And it says that in part, this upsurge in flat construction is having some profound effects. In some areas, the intrusion of flats into a community of private homes arouses indignation and alarm. The building of multi-storied blocks is widely regarded as an infringement of privacy, quite apart from increasing traffic and other problems associated with greater density. And there is complaint that homeowners cannot have any assurance whether their neighbourhood will be free of flat building or not. It's rather ironic that it wasn't very long ago that a property in Mount Albert was subject to a legal action regarding flat development, and that property had been previously owned by Mr. Hamer, who wrote this letter. yes, Monmouth Avenue. It just goes on then to explain how it was intended that local government's authorities should in fact address this question, should identify areas within their municipality which would be suitable for increased residential densities, as well as areas where it should be restricted. And the council then, with Kevin Mithen as the town planner, set out to adopt a policy which in fact was adopted in 1969. Previous to the control under the planning scheme, and it's mentioned in this letter, the only control over building of flats was via the building regulations. And really, they addressed the matters of light and ventilation and so forth that were important, but didn't really address the amenity considerations that the planning scheme sought to do. So the council had a policy adopted, and one of the first public meetings that I can ever remember being involved with was held in the downstairs of the new, well, not now new, but then new Civic Centre. The building, that part of the floor would be double the size of this, I guess, and it was packed to the walls, and it was quite an issue. I think one of my first involvements with community groups was the Vernal Avenue residents, who on the first draft of the flats policy were identified because of the size of their allotments and the fact that they were reasonably conveniently located to shops and transport, were identified as a high density area. And the high density area was about one dwelling unit to every 250 square metres or something. It was probably in square feet in those days. It was a group of people who were really determined that they would change that, and they persisted. And gradually, one step at a time, it became from a high density area, a medium density area, and then a low density area, and I think ultimately became a restricted low density area. So they persisted and they won through. The policy was reviewed in 1978, and it was reviewed again in 1984. The 1978 review didn't do anything too drastic except change a few zones.